This week marks the fifth anniversary of Hurricane Katrina's landfall. TV critic David Bianculli says that television was all over the story then and is all over it again now.
Whatever approach you'd like to see in a fifth anniversary update of Hurricane Katrina's impact on the Gulf region, TV provides it this week. A pure look back with retrospective clips and reflection? Check. Fresh reporting, digging up new angles and important stories? Check. A detailed update focusing not only on what happened then, but what has happened since? Check. All you have to do is know where to go. So here's a roadmap. Tonight at 9 Eastern Time on the National Geographic Channel, a two-hour special called Witness Katrina covers the August 2005 disaster from ground level. It collects images and recordings not from TV reporters on assignment, but from Gulf residents in their homes, holding camcorders or making phone calls as the massive storm surge comes closer and closer. Here are two such samples. First, from a woman filming as her house becomes a virtual island, then from another woman apologetically calling 911 for help a little too late. In both instances, what's so haunting is the calmness.
We are totally flooded. This is the bedroom. The bed is floating away, all the pillows, the cedar chest, everything floating away. I'm going to walk over here to the windows. I can't go outside anymore to take video. But if you can see out there, it is like we're in the middle of a river. We are totally surrounded by water. We've lost everything.
911, what's your emergency?
Hey, baby, we were stupid. We're down on the beach. I'm in a solid house. I'm on the third floor. We're not sure what we should do, if we should try...
The only thing I can tell you to do is pretty much do what you got to do, because we can't get nobody to you right now.
Okay.
And we'll get somebody out there as soon as we can.
All right. Well, if work comes to work, my name is Ida.
Mm-hmm.
And I tell my family I love them.
On the other end of the spectrum, there's the raw emotion in this Wednesday's edition of the PBS series Frontline. Called Law and Disorder, it devotes itself to one specific incident amid all that chaos. The shooting of a young man, and the severe beating endured by the man's brother when he went in search of medical help. Both the shooting and the beating, this investigative report concludes, were done by New Orleans police. At the end of the program, the surviving brother bursts into tears when discussing the cop who beat him. But he's crying not from rage, but from compassion.
I forgive that police officer. I forgive him with all my heart, because if I don't, God ain't gonna forgive me when I do something wrong. I forgive him. I forgive him. And I'm trying to deal with this every day. It's hard, man. I feel like something just is gone. That I had in my heart is gone. I ain't gonna get it. I can't see him no more. Can't do the things we normally do. You know, I miss my brother. I miss him.
Then, for recaps and reflections of the TV coverage itself, there was NBC's Dateline special, which ran last night. Brian Williams, whose reports from New Orleans were some of the most impressive, discussed his memories of covering the flooded city streets, quite candidly, in a session taped shortly after the disaster itself.
We made a decision. The French Quarter was no longer safe.
Things were getting too dicey. And we pulled out to the suburb of Metairie, Louisiana.
And good evening from Metairie, Louisiana.
I'll be candid. We heard CNN pulled out. That had some influence on our decision. We had no weapons. We don't work that way. That has to separate us as journalists. But it wasn't safe. So here we are driving through town in our rental cars. State troopers had to cover us by aiming at the men in the street just to tell them, don't think of doing a smash and grab and killing this guy for the car.
5 years later, that really brings you back. Nothing does it quite so much, though, as the footage itself. Of the flooding, the people on rooftops holding signs for help, the bloated dead bodies floating in canals and even streets. The outrage that had happened here in the United States remains fresh. And in Spike Lee's new HBO documentary on the disaster and its aftermath, a follow-up to his earlier special, he includes several pieces of TV news that still sting. One is the infamous "doing a heck of a job, Brownie" remark by then-President George Bush. The other is CNN reporter Soledad O'Brien's interview with that very Brownie, Michael Brown, then the head of the FEMA Government Response Agency, whose response to O'Brien, 5 days after tragedy struck, leaves her incredulous.
FEMA's been on the ground for 4 days, going into the fifth day. Why no massive airdrop of food and water? In Banda Aceh, in Indonesia, they got a food drop 2 days after the tsunami struck.
We're feeding those people in the convention center. We have fed over 150,000 people as of last night. That is happening.
But I guess the point is, as of last night, sir, forgive me, I have to stop you here.
What we're hearing is that we're hearing people's frustration. There are people that are beginning to manifest themselves out of the community that we didn't know that were there.
Why are you discovering this now? It's 5 days that FEMA's been on the ground. The head of police says it's been 5 days that FEMA's been there. The mayor, the former mayor, putting out SOSs on Tuesday morning, crying on national television, saying, please send in some troops. So the idea that, yes, I understand that you're feeding people and trying to get in there now, but it's Friday. It's Friday.
Whether people want to believe
But it's not all bad news and rehash. That same Spike Lee documentary, which is called If God Is Willing and the Creek Don't Rise, and airs tonight and tomorrow night at 9 Eastern on HBO, covers new ground. Too much, actually, squeezing in both this year's Super Bowl win by the New Orleans Saints and the BP mega oil spill. But it also looks for signs of hope in the rebuilding of New Orleans and vicinity, and finds them, among other places, in the infamous Lower Ninth Ward, where actor Brad Pitt and his business partner, both heard here, have arranged for the design and construction of hundreds of new homes for low-income residents.
What you see here now is just under 50 houses either lived in or under construction. But it's more than that. We rejected the idea that affordable housing has to, you know, use crap materials, toxic materials, and appliances that run up a family's utility bills.
As you can see here, we've put solar panels on all the houses, and these panels on a day like today provide enough electricity to run the entire house. So this house is feeding electricity back to the grid, which makes the electricity bills next to nothing.
They are safe because we don't know. We don't know about this wall here. We know it's safer. We got to make sure that these homes are going to be here if something like that were to happen again.
The point of all these TV specials is clear. We shouldn't forget what happened 5 years ago. And TV, more than any other medium, brings it back the most vividly, the way we first experienced it.
David Bianculli is founder and editor of TVWorthWatching.com, and he teaches TV and film at Rowan University in New Jersey. You can download podcasts of our show on our website, freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Our associate producer for online media is Melody Kramer. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
This is Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Allison Keyes. Michelle Martin is away. He became a worldwide sensation thanks to YouTube. For 24-year-old Antoine Dotson, it all started when he rescued his sister from an apparent sexual assault and was interviewed as part of a local TV story on WAFF in Huntsville, Alabama.
Kelly Dodson was asleep with a little girl inside their apartment on Webster Drive when
I was attacked by some idiot from out here in the projects.
Dodson struggled with her attacker, knocking over items in her bedroom. Antoine Dodson heard his sister scream and ran to help.
Well, obviously we have a rapist in Lincoln Park. He's climbing in your windows. He's snatching your people up, trying to rape them. So y'all need to hide your kids, hide your wife, and hide your husband because they're raping everybody out here.
The video of the TV story was posted on YouTube and earned millions of views thanks to Antoine's rant against the attacker. Then a band called the Gregory Brothers fashioned a song from the video called The Bed Intruder Rap. And even though it seems to mock Mr. Dodson, the band promised to share the proceeds with him.
He's climbing in your windows, he's snatching your people up, trying to break them, so y'all need to hide your kids, hide your wife, hide your kids, hide your wife, hide your kids, hide your wife, and hide your husband, because they're raping everybody out here. Yeah.
You don't have to come and confess. We're looking for you.
Dotson is also selling t-shirts. He's asking for donations, and he created MyFanLine.com, a site where the public can reach out to him. The Antoine Dotson phenomenon doesn't sit well with some African Americans, though, and we'll talk with a technology and social media expert and with a cultural commentator in a couple of minutes. But we decided we'd reach out to Antoine, too. He joins us now from WLRH in Huntsville, Alabama. Welcome, Antoine.
Hey, thanks for having me.
I have to start out, though, on a much more serious note. Talk to us a little bit about the assault itself and your family's reaction. Is everybody okay?
Yeah, it's been 3 weeks. Everybody is okay. We're dealing with it day by day, but we're getting a lot of smiles out of the family, so it's getting back to normal.
Has your sister or the rest of your family gotten counseling? Have you guys had to talk to anybody, or are you just kind of working through it on your own?
Actually, like, we have been in similar situations, never when somebody come into our window or whatever, but we just deal with it on our own. You know, we talk to each other and try to comfort each other, and that's the best way we know how to deal with stuff like this.
So your family's having to deal with the aftermath of this really frightening attack. And then these videos happen. I mean, there are more than 10 million hits on one of them. There were 4 million hits on the TV news story alone. I mean, what on earth did you think about that?
I know I was like really tripping because, you know, I have done like interviews on the news before or whatever, but it was about a child who had got hit by a car and she ended up passing. And so I was telling them that they should put, like, what you call them, speed bumps in the street to keep people from speeding so fast, you know, in the projects or whatever. And that didn't do nothing. And then when this happened, I was like, wow, I can't believe it went crazy like this. Like, everybody seen the video. It was amazing.
Were you surprised? I mean, are people stopping you on the street, shaking your hand?
Yes, everywhere I go. Everywhere I go, is somebody stopped. Hey, you're the YouTube guy, or you're Antoine. Oh, you're my hero. And that's pretty cool when people can sit and say, you're a hero, you know, like, that's really cool.
Do you feel like a hero?
Not really, because I always protect my sisters, and I have brothers too, so I protect them too. I'm the oldest of six, so it's pretty much a daily job for me.
Big brother in the house. How do you feel, by the way, about the video, the Gregory brothers who produced that music video of you and your sister's words?
Well, you know, the guy haven't been caught yet, but us hearing that video, it had gave us some type of happiness. It gave us some type of comfort, because out of this all, that video, we really liked it. Like, it was really cool, especially to hear our voice on the track. And, you know, it's on iTunes and everything. That was really cool, and it did bring some happiness.
You know, there are some folk that might think you're being exploited or that people are making fun of you. What do you think about people that think that?
I mean, there's nothing you can do about it. People are going to talk and people are going to say stuff. I'm a joker anyway. Like, me and my family, we play jokes on each other all the time. So basically, you know, people are going to talk. They can say what they want. It's not going to change us.
There were also some people that called the actual TV station and basically said that you were being portrayed kind of like a character of African Americans. And some people have said the same thing about the videos. Do you think they're wrong or right?
I mean, I know that people probably, in it for the wrong reason, they're trying to make fun of it. But you know what I'm saying? It's sad that people have so much negative to say about the situation, because this is a serious matter. But people are going to talk. We can't stop them from talking.
So as far as you're concerned, race is not an issue in what's going on here?
Not at all. Not to me and my family.
All right. So how has your life changed after these events? I was hearing that you guys are getting ready to make a move.
Yeah, so far, my life changed. Like, I never in my life done radio before. So it's like now, ever since this happened, we getting all these radio shows, and I have did this commercial or whatever for First Family Mortgage. So it's like cool. A lot of opportunities is coming. We're just trying to get everything on the table and discuss everything so I don't make no crazy choices.
With all the fame and fortune being thrown your way, so are you going to pack up and move to the Big Apple or out to L.A.? Or shall we see you on the big screen sometime?
Hopefully, that'd be nice. And I would love to come to a big city, because I'm from a big city myself. So I like the fast life. I'm not going to lie.
I'm shocked to hear that. What are you hoping to accomplish out of your fan line?
I just hope that I can comfort people, because most of the people that I talk to and interact with, it's people who have been in similar situations or been a victim of rape. And I just want to comfort them and give them a couple of, you know, ways that I have dealt with the situation. So basically, I'm trying to be an inspiration to people.
What's your sister think about all of this?
At first, she hated it. She was like, Kevin, they're trying to make a fool out of you. Just let it go. Don't even worry about it. But I was like, Kelly, this could be an opportunity for our family to get out of the hood. You know what I'm saying? So I took it and I was running with it, and I'm still running with it.
All right. Just one last question, Antoine. Besides your helping to inspire rape victims, what are you hoping to get out of this for yourself? What's your goal, do you think?
I would like to write, you know, do writing. I love to write. That's like a passion for me. And I would like to step out into the fashion world. You know, like, I'm into shoes and clothes and accessories. I love stuff like that. Like, I want to be there.
Huntsville, Alabama resident Antoine Dotson says he is supporting his family with the money and fame he's received from a YouTube video that railed against the bed intruder who broke into his house and tried to rape his sister. He was kind enough to join us from WLRH in Huntsville, Alabama. Thanks, Antoine, for being on the program.
Thank you so much for having me. Take care.
Welcome back to All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Audie Cornish, and I have a confession. I'm addicted to television soap operas. My favorite is General Hospital, and maintaining that addiction for the last 20 years hasn't been easy. These days, I'm down to reading transcripts on my BlackBerry. Now, most women have just given up. In the last 30 years, the number of soaps has dwindled from 18 to just 6. And one of these shows, As the World Turns, signs off next month after a 54-year run. Peter Brash is a veteran of the soapy small screen, and until last year, he was a staff writer for that show. Peter Brash, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
Tell me, why do you think soaps are dying?
Well, I think in large measure, I think soaps in general have become victims of their own success. The serialized format has spread out just about everywhere you look, you know, from reality TV to shows like Mad Men and The Sopranos and any talent show or reality show. It's all branded to hook you in to tune in tomorrow or next week.
Also, there are just fewer people at home to watch.
Oh, absolutely.
Or I should say fewer women at home.
Right. It was all about women. In fact, in years past, if a woman heard I was on a soap opera, oh, they'd be all over me. They'd want to know, what shows have you written? What characters? Oh, what are they like in real life? Oh, tell me the storylines. Oh, please. Now it goes over with a thud.
How much of an impact do you think that reality television has had on this medium in particular?
I think that was an especially difficult situation for soap operas. There's something about reality shows now that they're soap operas in themselves. They're just real.
Right. So, there's a leading man. There's often a vamp. There's often a turncoat kind of character.
Right.
Or
and it's always
a
as
villain.
Outrageous as the soaps are, too, and larger-than-life characters and the crazy goings-on. And
right, and right down to the catfights, I think.
Right. So, you know, the audience is savvy enough to know that they're watching one that's real. Oh, she's really pulling her hair, and oh, my God, she might hurt her. And the other one is staged. So which one becomes more compelling?
You left As the World Turns last year. What's your most unusual storyline?
Once I was responsible for having two naked people fall from a meteor shower, and they seem
That's
to
awesome.
Be...
That's awesome.
Yeah, they seem to be from another planet, and they ran around naked one summer in Salem. I probably should have told the audience right away that the mad scientist in town had just, you know, put them up in a rocket ship, and they really weren't aliens. It's always better if the audience is in on the joke in that way. But it was kind of fun to see this brother and sister, the Gemini twins, running around naked around Salem all summer.
And Peter, culturally, what kind of loss do you think this is to this landscape?
Well, you know, in a funny way, I don't really think it is a loss. It's not that soap operas are dying. It's that soap operas are kind of lending their DNA to the rest of the entertainment media world. And that includes dramatic and reality. So I don't think it's a dead medium. It's just morphing into different things.
Peter Brash was a staff writer on As the World Turns and the co-head writer on Days of Our Lives. He joined us from our New York bureau. Peter Brash, thanks so much.
Thank you.
A new poll out this week says 20% of Americans, that's 56 million people, have played a game on social networks like Facebook in the last 3 months. Now, most people play for free, but enough of them play with real money for virtual property that these games generated $725 million in revenue last year. Maybe the most popular of these games is called Farmville. We asked a few players for their stories, and these aren't what you usually think of as gamers.
My name is Lee Francine. I am from Fort Mill, South Carolina. My grandmother-in-law, she is 83 years old. She wears thick glasses. She has curly gray hair.
I think she's about 4 years widowed now.
Lives with my mother-in-law. My mother-in-law was recently returning from a trip out of town. As soon as she got home, my grandmother-in-law comes out in the back porch to meet her, and she's very upset. She's distraught, and she says, "Well, my dog is in the pound." And my mother-in-law says, "What do you mean your dog's in the pound?" She thought for a minute she was talking about her Boston Terrier. And she says, "No, my dog on Farmville. My dog's been thrown in the pound. You've got to go to the store and you've got to buy farm dollars for me." The obvious answer was to drive 30 miles to Target, buy the card for $30, and turn around and drive back home that very night so she could get her dog out of the pound.
I got the farmland blues. I got the farmland blues right now.
Hi, my name is Terry Garrido.
I'm Don Wright.
My name is Terry Bogier. I live in Birmingham, Alabama.
Ostrander, Ohio.
Issaquah, Washington. With a couple of my kids and a big dog and a garden, and life is great.
The games make you interact with other
people that I haven't talked to in 35 years.
From all over the country.
200 people that you haven't talked to in 20 plus years. Kind of a trip. My girl is 7 years old. She plays a number of the games that I play. We'll be back to back or next to each other on PCs playing these Farmville games, and she has learned a tremendous amount. There's a commerce aspect, a growing time and a harvesting, and we don't spend very much time on it, so it's not like we're spending 3 hours in front of a computer. But every couple of days, she says, "Let's check the farm and see what's going on."
Girl from Egypt that comes to mind. We've talked about politics, and it's really interesting because in her real life, she's afraid to talk about politics. But I mean, I've reached mutual respect and understandings with her and learned things from her in ways that, you know, I never would have expected from the game.
It's not a tremendous amount of money. I think I'm into them for less than $100 at this point. As time goes on, I'm sure they'll get more of my cash. I don't smoke, so how do people waste their money on cigarettes? But if it's something that brings them pleasure, then, you know, who am I to judge?
I got the farmland blues right now.
Still, you gotta ask, is it odd to spend real money on virtual tomato seeds or a dog in the virtual pound? Or is their value no different than a movie ticket or an entertaining book?
Or a diamond, you know? I mean, most of a diamond's value isn't in the diamond. It's what we think of diamonds, right?
That's Clive Thompson. He's a technology writer for Wired and the New York Times Magazine.
If you spend a lot of time in online games, the awesomeness of your farm, the awesomeness of the rare things you've got is exactly like a diamond, because that's where your friends see it.
We should point out that a vast majority of players do not spend real money to play games like Farmville. Only about 10% do. And I asked Clive Thompson how that works as a business model.
If you've got millions and millions of people playing, you only need to shave off, you know, 10% of those who are going to throw $50 at it, you know, a month, and suddenly you've got $50 million a month coming in.
How is this different from traditional gaming? You know, there's been The Sims around forever, mm-hmm. and these sort of massive online player communities where there have been marketplaces of one kind or another. So what is different? What's changing?
Well, the reason why this has gone so huge is that Facebook has this massive user base of people that are totally avid and are hooked up with all their friends. And this gives them something to do while they're in Facebook that's also social, you know, because you can actually do better by helping out other friends. So they sort of get you on side with making it viral because you sort of strong arm your friends who aren't playing Farmville into playing Farmville. So it's very well designed.
And the idea is to enhance—is it to make yourself better as a player?
Well, to a certain extent, the logic of games like this, these multiplayer games, is they give you something very simple to do, and it can be just sort of a fun way to while away some time when you're at work. You need 15 minutes just to not think about anything, and this gets your mind off everything else. It's the same reason people play Tetris and all those different things. But what makes this different from, you know, just sort of zoning it for 15 minutes with Tetris is that you know, the more you play, the more experience you accrue, the more gifts you can give to friends. So it starts sort of building on itself. That's what results in the sort of, you know, 3 a.m., oh my goodness, I've been playing Farmville for 7 hours, how did this happen, phenomena that has been around for a long time in virtual world games, where people get very addicted to these very simple things that slowly build up your power or your prestige or your money or whatever, and time really slips away.
And this sort of shadow economy that's building in the gaming world, I mean, it's estimated that it's up to $1.6 billion a year in the U.S. alone. Is this a serious economic model for the future?
Well, you know, a lot of people have wondered about that, ranging from economists to tax authorities. Because, you know, you think about it from the IRS's point of view. If someone is inside a game and they build up tens of thousands or millions of gold pieces, and those gold pieces can be sold to someone else for, you know, a couple thousand dollars, haven't they effectively just done something, like a wagering activity that ought to be taxed, you know? And so the IRS sort of wonders about this stuff. Now, they haven't actually really come down on either side of it very heavily because the stakes aren't yet big enough. But one can imagine a period in the future when enough people are doing things like this that is really worth something in the outside world that, you know, tax authorities start going, you know, we want a piece of this. This is an active discussion amongst economists who follow virtual economies.
That's Clive Thompson, a technology writer for Wired and the New York Times Magazine. He joined us from our NPR bureau in New York City. Clive Thompson, thank you.
No problem.